WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
Has it been a week already? Well, you know what we do around here on Fridays. We dig into our weekly news recap. That's when we cover the top stories that you need to know about. Stories like these.
Low-level gun cases, the least serious of gun cases. They don't need to come through felony review.
The Chicago City Council has given the stamp of approval to Mayor Johnson's pick for 35th Ward Alderman.
Anthony Quesada will fill the vacancy left by Carlos Ramirez Rosa.
I've always believed that the guiding principle of government must be to do the greatest good.
If you've participated in a violent insurrection to overthrow the government and undo an election, you shouldn't be able to find employment in any government.
Let's meet this week's world-class panel of local journalists. Brandis Friedman is anchor of WTTW's Chicago Tonight and host of Chicago Tonight Black Voices. Great to see you again.
Likewise, thank you.
Tom Shuba is a reporter and editor for the Chicago Sun-Times. Welcome back, Tom.
Always a pleasure.
And rounding out our panel today is Quinn Myers, who covers the Wicker Park, Bucktown, and Westtown neighborhoods, as well as City Council for Block Club Chicago. Great to have you back in studio.
Hey, hey, great to be back.
Starting with City Council, and President Trump may have pardoned the January 6th rioters, but Chicago alders, they're not as forgiving. What is happening, Quinn?
Yeah, right. So Alderman Gil Villegas is leading this push to ban anyone who was convicted of a crime related to the January 6th insurrection from holding any position under city employ. Really similar to a ban that Governor Pritzker pushed for at the state level earlier this year. Basically, the argument is, if you were part of this violent insurrection trying to overthrow the U.S. government, why should you have any kind of place in our city or state government? Interestingly, I do think a lot of this is some political posturing, maybe you would say, because there are only about 50 people in the whole state of Illinois who were convicted on January 6th related crimes. There is one police officer who at the time was a Chicago police officer who was involved at January 6th. He is no longer with the force. So it does protect the city, I guess, against any of these people, working here in the future, although it's a pretty limited, scale is what I would say.
Yeah. So anyone on the committee oppose the ordinance?
A few people, Alderman Nick Spezzato, who is one of the more conservative members of the city council, was against it. He did condemn January 6th, but, it did receive a mostly favorable recommendation, and now it goes to the full city council next week.
Interestingly, like, one of Spezzato's arguments is, I think we're cherry picking here, right? Why not the Black Lives Matter protest? Because he says it's a protest that turned into a riot. What is it? Can you equate those? So I think, it protests that turned into a riot. And while he condemned what happened on January 6th, I think one of his colleagues in city council was like, no, it was actually an insurrection. So I think he is seen to be taking it a little lightly.
Yeah, and as we've talked about on the program, Tom, I mean, there were Chicago police officers at the January 6th insurrection, were there not?
Well, there was one specifically who was convicted for entering the Capitol that day. Carol Cheswick is his name. And he went to D.C. with his sister. He was photographed wearing a CPD sweatshirt. Mm-hmm. He was bragging online about getting into a fight with a political adversary. And he was placed on leave, or he went on leave from the Chicago Police Department. And he actually went on leave because he couldn't, under the conditions of his release in his criminal case, have a firearm. And so he kept extending his, his leave with the department until they ultimately just summarily fired him. So he's no longer a police officer, but he would likely be somewhat prohibited from future employment.
On the state level, Brandis, Illinois already got a ban on hiring January 6th attendees. But Mayor Johnson didn't quite follow the governor's lead. Any thoughts as to why?
That is interesting, right? Because Mayor Johnson did say that he supports what the governor is doing, despite, you know, sometimes those two don't always get along and see eye to eye. And he says, yeah, that's, you know, sure, a good thing. But he wasn't quite ready to support one with the city. And so I'm curious about what his reasoning is. And maybe, you know, a little bit to Quinn's point, does he kind of recognize that this is a little bit of political posturing and that it's not necessarily effective? I don't know.
Well, Quinn, Mayor Johnson's affordable housing strategy, that also came under fire in city council. Tell us about the proposal and then what Alders thought.
A little bit. So this is known as the Green Social Housing Ordinance. And basically what this would do is set up a city-run nonprofit kind of overseen by the Department of Housing to manage this revolving loan fund using money from this big bond deal the council passed last year to basically provide construction loans and other equity to affordable housing developers. These would be mixed-use and kind of mixed-income developments. But they would have about 30% affordable units, which is about 10% higher than the current city regulation.
Yeah.
They would also be built with these pretty strict environmental codes. They'd be so-called green housing. So this has gotten a lot of support from the city council, but there were some objections during a committee hearing on Wednesday, particularly over the governance of this nonprofit. People had concerns about how the mayor was going to appoint these people, whether they would be subject to the Open Meetings Act, FOIA, that sort of thing. That was one of the big sticking points. So basically they recessed and they're going to kind of hammer out some of the details and they're coming back on Monday. I would bet that if, you know, it comes back, they will vote favorably in support of this, but we'll see what happens. I do think a lot of people were saying we support this in theory. There's just more details that need to be worked out. But basically this would allow the city and, affordable housing developers to kind of skip going to private equity, to banks for parts of these loans, and they could get loans at lower interest rates. Basically encourage more affordable housing development.
Interesting. City Council's got a lot on their hands. They're also dealing with a couple of police misconduct settlements. What's the latest, Tom?
Sure. So in the latest drumbeat of the money that the city will be paying out, there's a $32 million settlement in a crash that left a St. Louis man was hit in Streeterville. In 2022, both of his legs had to be amputated. It was a really traumatic event. He was with his family at the time.
And he was hit by a driver that was being chased by police.
Indeed. It was a police chase, which we've seen the story play out. It seems like month after month when we get the Finance Committee kind of agenda, there's a massive settlement for a chase-related incident. Obviously, the city has changed its chase policy to try to, make the streets safer and to save taxpayers money. This is one from 2022 that they're just getting to $32 million.
City Council was also scheduled to vote on the $1.25 million settlement for Dexter Reed's family. I know that happened this morning. So give us the latest on the vote and remind folks of the details of that case.
Sure. Dexter Reed was killed in a shootout with police. It started when plainclothes officers pulled him over in Humboldt Park. This was in March of 2024. Reed allegedly shot one of the five officers who approached his car first. The four other officers then, in a matter of seconds, unleashed nearly 100 rounds of bullets. He was struck 13 times. He was killed. Mm. At one point, he tried to leave his car. Officers continued to shoot at him, including when he was on the ground. This was, the video footage is incredibly jarring. And this was, the latest police shooting in Chicago that has really rocked the city. And today, we're just seeing the news roll in right before we came in here that a committee has blocked a $1.25 million settlement to his family. So this was deferred, this vote, and now it's been blocked. And so this battle over whether to pay out his family will continue, whether it, comes back up to committee or it's renegotiated or it ultimately goes to trial. We don't know.
What's this back and forth been looking like from your view, Quinn?
You know, I think people who voted in favor of this say this is going to save the city a lot of money. I mean, $1.25 million for a settlement versus spending up to possibly, $10 million. I mean, that's an estimate, but millions of dollars in legal fees plus, a larger payout if the if a court does find the city liable here. But then, you know, some of the more conservative aldermen, and definitely some of the more pro-police aldermen, are saying, you know, he Reed shot first. There should be no consideration in which this body gives him any money. I believe Alderman Ray Lopez today even suggested the city should sue Reed's family over recouping some of the costs to the city. So it is a, you know, kind of a classic conversation in Chicago about how we deal with police misconduct. And if, you know, there's still, as Tom can talk about, I think there's still like big questions over what misconduct occurred here. Or, you know, COPA is investigating and all this stuff. We still don't even know the results of a lot of that either.
Mm. Well, Mayor Johnson got his first aldermanic appointment approved this week. Can you fill us in on what's going on in the 35th Ward, Quinn?
Sure. Anthony Cazada is the new 35th Ward alderman. He was Cook County Commissioner, and he was definitely the big favorite for this job. He worked for Carlos Ramirez Rosa, who he is replacing as a constituent services director. He's been kind of a lifelong Logan Square resident, and he was really Carlos's protege in a lot of ways.
So no controversies or concerns surrounding him?
There is one over a tweet he made in high school in 2014, where he used the N-word in a tweet. And he has since apologized for this multiple times and, you know, said, put out a statement about it. And a lot of aldermen on Monday did say that they forgave him, including black aldermen, and a few did not. They talked about some took issue with his apology. Others, I think, took issue more with his politics over his tweet from high school.
So I want to turn to a couple more law enforcement stories, and I'm looking directly at you, Tom. Cook County State's Attorney Eileen O'Neill Burke, she was making headlines. I want to start with one concerning electronic monitoring. What's going on there?
Sure. So first of all, electronic monitoring has been a, you know, controversial, grew more controversial after there was this overhaul, criminal justice overhaul law passed by the state that, you know, sought to release more people on electronic monitoring. So O'Neill Burke has now directed members of her office to formally kind of put their hand up and say, we, you know, object when a Cook County judge doesn't, you know, hold a person in custody as prosecutors have requested. So a prosecutor can say, we believe this person is a flight risk or a danger to community. Judge, we believe that you should hold them at the Cook County Jail while they await trial. And if a judge says, no, I believe that we're going to release them on electronic monitoring, O'Neill Burke told her prosecutors to put it in the record. We oppose that decision. So this is interesting. It comes at a time when it used to be the sheriff's office that monitored people who are under electronic monitoring.
Right.
That's being shifted to the chief judge's office. There are questions about how equipped the chief judge's office is to handle this. And frankly, the sheriff's office has said that they had issues with how equipped they were to handle it. And so O'Neill Burke has essentially posed this as a safety issue. And so, you know, this is going to be something to keep eyes on, especially as, you know, these reforms continue to, you know, we continue to get an understanding of how these reforms have affected, you know, crime and safety in the city, too.
The state's attorney is also coming under criticism for a pilot program. This is to change how felony gun possession cases are brought in Southside police districts. So what are the details there?
Sure. So this is the 5th District, the Calumet District, and the 7th District, the Englewood District, and officers there will be allowed to directly file charges in the lowest level gun cases. That means they won't have to go to a judge or to a prosecutor and say, we want you to approve these charges and to file them. They'll be able to just say, I caught this guy with a gun, I'm taking him to the station, and I'm going to directly file charges. They do this in some misdemeanor cases already, but some alders are upset. They said they didn't get enough notification about this. There wasn't enough community input. I talked to Superintendent Snelling about this. What he said was, this is going to get cops back on the street quicker. It's going to, you know, give prosecutors more time to do their work. And there is a important thing that he noted, which was that the only cases that can be direct filed, there has to be body cam footage of the arrests that will be able to back up and corroborate, you know, the officer's claims in filing the charges. I also asked in one of these districts, the 5th District, there was a real issue. Superintendent Snelling has pushed to fire 4 officers from the district were taking guns off the street, and then they were lying without making arrests and then lying about where the guns came from. He said that was an isolated incident with this crew, and you know, he acted and moved that way because he couldn't trust them because they lied. And so, but another thing to keep in mind is there was this scandal around guns in that district.
Yeah, you're nodding, Brandis. What do you think about all this and why this might be so controversial?
So, well, there's another point that the aldermen make as well. Not only that they feel like they didn't have, you know, notification, which and they felt like there wasn't enough community input. The other point that they make is that the districts where this is being piloted and only going into effect are predominantly Black communities. And so a lot of them are saying that this has the potential to be, you know, one set of laws for one community that's mostly Black when the rest of all the other communities aren't under the same rule, basically, and that layer of oversight, because the Cook County Public Defender Sharon Mitchell's office also released a statement concerned about this pilot as well, saying that this removes a critical layer of oversight over police officers who sometimes, you know, are problematic, not all of them, obviously, but there's that layer of oversight that's missing. And then, of course, there's the issue with the aldermen that this is mostly impacting predominantly Black communities right now.
And Snelling, who worked in the Englewood district, is from Englewood. He responded to a question I had about this, and he said, "This isn't about race. We're targeting places where there are the most guns and there was the most gun violence." So that's been his response to that.
Yeah.
But absolutely, this is an issue.
So some valid points on the other side there. I want to head now to the Dirksen courthouse because, well, another week, another politician facing federal charges. Brandis, what is happening with State Senator Emil Jones III?
Okay, so he is accused of accepting alleged bribes from a red light camera company executive and it ended up being that executive who cooperated with the feds and ended up, you know, bringing this whole case down. So from to my understanding, you know, he is alleged to have had a dinner with this red light camera company executive. And in that dinner, you know, they're discussing things like, oh, you can, you know, raise $5,000 for me. You can, the former or the current state senator is accused of saying to the executive.
Yeah.
I need this intern to have a job who ends up having a job and does no work. And so all of that was supposed to be to support. I'm not entirely clear on what he was expected to do, but it was all related to legislation that would have impacted this red light camera company.
Basically, to water it down.
Basically, yeah, weaken it, loosen the teeth a little bit.
Yeah. And how's he responding to these charges?
How is he responding to these charges?
Well, he hasn't resigned. He's fighting them. Yep.
He's like, I am not going anywhere.
We'll see what happens. Yeah. I mean, he, you know, if he is convicted, he would be forced to give up his seat in the legislature, obviously. You know, his father, Emil Jones Jr., was a pretty powerful Illinois politician. He was the Illinois Senate president in the 2000s. So Emil Jones III, you know, does come from this kind of political dynasty here.
But he's in all this legal drama over
$5,000. He's in all this legal drama, you know? And yeah, and I think that's probably a question he's probably asking himself. Was it worth it for $5,000 and getting an intern or do-nothing job with this company? So, or with this executive. So, yeah, just kind of the latest case that's, you know, roiling.
Not even minimum wage for the intern. It was $15 an hour.
Well, and I think there was like an expectation that he would, you know, take a plea and cooperate or whatever, just kind of roll over and not fight it. But I think because there was that Supreme Court ruling with regards to bribery, and that I think that's the same ruling that the Madigan attorneys were looking at and going, I wonder if this might work to our benefit, and I wonder if the same consideration is at play here.
It'll be interesting to see how the jury feels about all of this.
Yes, it will. In a few days, we'll
know. That is for sure. Back in 2022, when these charges were first brought against Emil Jones, Illinois State President Don Harmon called for his resignation. Now, this week, Don Harmon's facing his own issues in response to a Tribune investigation. Tom, fill us in. What do you know?
Yeah, so it seems like the Tribune noticed something in campaign finance reports that Harmon filed, and they flagged them to the state board of the state election officials, and election officials ultimately found that Harmon had taken in roughly $4.1 million more in donations last year than were legally allowed. And so, you know, they alerted Harmon to this. according to the Tribune's reporting, he says that he doesn't, quote, agree with their determination, and he's, quote, confident that this will be resolved. He could face a $6.1 million fine, but that likely won't happen in most of these cases. As the Tribune reports, these are kind of settled out or appealed. And so the election officials, it's kind of toothless, some of this enforcement, it seems. But we'll see how it plays out.
Yeah. And how's Senate president, I'm correcting myself from earlier, how's Harmon responding to all of this?
Well, he said that he disagrees with this finding. And that he's, you know, he thinks
I'm sure we'll get to the bottom of this.
Yeah.
And resolved.
Certainly he's been in the legislature long enough to know, you know, how most of these cases do get resolved. So, you know, it seemed a bit like he brushed it off a little when talking to the Trib.
Now, Quinn, yesterday in a social media post, what is new, Donald Trump threatened to, quote, withhold all federal funding from sanctuary cities. We're a sanctuary city. How did Mayor Johnson respond to that?
We are, and we receive billions of dollars in federal funding. The Chicago mayor's office put out a statement that Chicago is expected to receive around $3.5 billion in federal funding this year. That does not include, money that the CTA is getting. Chicago Public Schools also gets over $1 billion in federal money. So, the mayor is basically kind of saying, you know, we're going to work to protect against federal overreach. He previously, you know, threatened to sue the federal government over loss of federal funding. That remains to be seen if that would actually happen. But I think it's important to note that the Trump administration, part one, tried to do something similar to this when Rahm Emanuel was mayor, and it went to court, and basically the court said, you can't do that. Like, you have to continue giving this federal funding. So it really is going to be a test of, you know, federal power versus local home rule power.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see if this gets dragged into the courts. Chicago is also suing, the federal government is also suing Chicago, Cook County, and the state over our sanctuary city state policies.
Right.
That's also moving through the courts as well.
And now we have Governor Pritzker being asked to testify before the House Oversight Committee about sanctuary city laws. He says he's, quote, evaluating the request.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to see if he actually goes. I think, when they tried to first announce that they wanted Mayor Johnson to go, I don't know if anyone expected him to go, and he did. And, you know, kind of had this much politicized hearing. So we'll see if Governor Pritzker goes. Certainly, I think he would be in a position to talk about this, whether he wants to for political reasons or not. We'll see.
Yeah. So, Brandis, there's been a lot of economic chaos lately, to put it mildly. Trump announced a 90-day pause on tariffs that still leaves a lot of uncertainty. You, this week, you got several local perspectives on tariffs. What did you hear from folks?
Everybody's got whiplash.
Yeah. They're like, I don't know. Are they on? Are they off?
What's happening? And then the market and which, yeah. So, yeah, we heard from several people, an economics professor, the head of the Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce, as well as a local small business owner in Andersonville. And of the three guests that we had, none of them are big fans. Economics professor explaining to us that he believes that, you know, he, as well as, like, you know, conservative or, you know, liberal-minded economists are all thinking that this is going to have a negative impact on the economy. Like, the Trump administration, their intention is, you know, to reduce unfair tariff and trade practices and to bring more jobs back to the United States. But folks are concerned that it is not going to have the intended effect, that it is going to increase prices, increase inflation, diminish jobs. We heard from the local small business owner who says that, you know, he and his husband, who own their stationery shop in Andersonville, are already noticing it. They buy product that is designed in Paris but created in China, and they received, you know, the $2,700 order in early February, and then a bit later, a $1,300 tariff bill to go along with it. And that stuff has been on the shelves for a little while, right? So if you don't pay that bill, then they start to accrue interest fees. And as a small business owner, how are you going to keep up with that?
Oh, yeah.
On the flip side, though, there are some businesses in the country who think it's a good thing. I was listening to NPR just last night, and you're obviously public broadcasting, supporting public broadcasting.
Yeah.
A shrimper in South Carolina is actually pleased because he feels that the shrimp that is farmed in South Asia that is it hits his business because his is wild caught shrimp and he can't compete with those prices, and he thinks that it's about time that we do something about those unfair trade practices.
Interesting. Yeah, we had a couple of small business owners on the program earlier this week as well, and you know, same worries, same concerns. Now this was the day before Trump put this 90-day pause, but of course still a lot of uncertainty, as I said. And I know your colleagues over at Block Club, Quinn, they had a story about a Southside coffee shop raising prices because it had, $2,000 that it had to pay for coffee beans?
Right.
$2,000 more than
right.
usual?
My colleague, Mac Lederman, did this story. He interviewed the owner of the Kusanya Cafe in Englewood, who had to pay $2,000 more for his latest shipment, and he's expecting to pass that cost onto the consumer.
Of course.
He also spoke with a Westside coffee shop who the owner bought a whole year's worth of Colombian coffee, ahead of these tariffs, basically to try to save money because you don't know if there's going to be another pause, if they're going to get reinstated. And coffee is a really interesting thing. You know, it's not grown in the U.S. at a mass scale. It has to be grown in certain climates. We have to import coffee, and we're all addicted to it. So
everybody in this room.
Everybody in this room.
No, ma'am.
I know you're not.
But it is. I think that is a particularly, a flashpoint. And there are, certainly other goods like that as well.
Yeah.
I'll be at the Costco this weekend loading up on coffee.
I'll help you load up.
Thank
or you.
You. Use your arms.
Schools, they're also impacted by presidential orders, including one demanding they eliminate DEI programs. So how is Illinois responding to that demand?
Yeah, so I mean, this is part of just the Trump administration's broadside against educational institutions kind of across the board. But how Illinois education officials responded was by sending a letter to the Federal Department of Education and saying, hey, we're already, this is what we're doing isn't discriminatory here, and we're already complying with the Civil Rights Act of 1964 that prohibits discrimination. So essentially, a stiff arm.
Yeah. Yeah. The letter said, quote, recent communications from the Department of Education represent an abrupt shift from previous positions and that the Department of Education cannot impose new requirements without adhering to rulemaking procedures. So, clear pushback there. Now, that presidential order issued last Thursday gives states and districts 10 days to eliminate DEI or risk losing Title I money. That's funding for low-income students. Yet Chicago public schools are sticking with efforts to improve Black student success. Brandis, what else can you share there?
They are. We reached out to CPS a good deal about this, obviously. And we ended up talking to some folks who helped to craft that plan. And it sounds like none of them are very concerned about unwinding it or rolling it back, which, honestly, that seems to be the stance that a lot of folks in Chicago and Illinois are kind of taking when it comes to some of this. Like, yeah, we're going to do it anyway. We heard from a couple of dads who helped to craft this program, and recognizing that, while Chicago public school students are, I think, approximately 30%-ish Black, that the district still has not done enough to improve achievement rates for them. It is being challenged, of course. The conservative group Parents Defending Education say that it is discriminatory because even the district itself recognizes that overall all students are not doing well enough with regards to what the achievement numbers show. So to only roll out a plan that supports Black students, they say that is, of course, discriminatory. And so the plan has several steps, like increasing, Black teachership. What's the word for that?
Retention.
Thank you.
Keeping Black teachers,
hiring Black teachers, because the research shows that that Black
teachership.
Students, a teacher. Thank you,
I like
everybody.
That.
I used
I like
to cover
that.
Education. I can make up a word. and so there's that's one of the policies. I think there are five specific goals that they've got with that intention.
Universities are also dealing with uncertainty, Quinn. What's happening at Northwestern and Evanston?
Right. So the Trump administration is really fighting this culture war against elite universities, higher education, and it has come to Chicago with Northwestern. They are pausing almost $800 million in federal funding. And that's amid an investigation into allegations of anti-Semitism and racial discrimination. They say, is tied to promoting diversity. Very similar messaging we've been talking about basically on the past whole show, really.
And the past 3 months.
Exactly. you know, North, this has basically been targeted at Ivy League schools, yeah. But Northwestern is not, but he's, you know, an elite school here in Chicago area. And this would be a massive, massive hit to their research, arm.
How's the school responding?
Basically, they're defending their work and they're saying, you know, we're doing research on Parkinson's disease. We're doing research on, you know, pacemakers, all these kinds of, robotics, military training. There was this stop work order from the Department of Defense to basically tell researchers at Northwestern to pause their research. So the university is defending themselves and saying, we're doing vital work that is good for our society. And, like other universities, we need this money to continue. So in terms of like the actual impact, though, we're going to wait and see how the fallout happens here. But there have, some labs have felt it already.
Yeah, more than 1,000 faculty, alumni, and students have signed on to a letter supporting academic freedom at the university. So, Tom, I mean, like other campuses, the president's demands, Trump's demands are likely putting Northwestern leadership in what sounds like a very difficult position.
Yeah. And I mean, we've seen leaders from other universities really get pressed and, be hauled in front of Congress. Mm-hmm. And
it's happening here, too.
And this is all about, the imposition of, ideology that's held by the administration. And what does this all boil down to, right? Like, this is a reactionary measure to how school administrations handled demonstrations of speech and protest on their campuses. But now we're seeing that it's having these very real world effects, which could have, ramifications so far down the line with the type of research that Quinn's
right.
talking about, lives, safety, all of these things. For like Quinn said, it's essentially advancing the culture yeah. war that had been playing out on college campuses, but raising the stakes
yeah.
in this huge way.
We'll definitely have to keep an eye on how this all plays out. We've also got reports of the Trump administration revoking visas for international students in universities across the state. University of Chicago officials say 3 students and 4 recent grads have had their visas revoked. University of Illinois and Northwestern students have also reportedly had their visas revoked. Sadly, separately, a fear of immigration raids has caused organizers of Pilsen's Cinco de Mayo parade in Little Village to cancel this year's event. Now, federal funding cuts are being felt at lots of other institutions locally, including libraries. Brandis, shed some light on that.
Yeah, so I recently the Institute of Museums and Library, or sorry, the Institute of Museum and Library Services, or IMLS, which is a lot easier to say, they received notification that their funding would be cut. And I mean, it's about $266.7 million that this institute awards to museums, libraries, and archives. That's annually, right? So. People who oppose this cut argue that that is a fraction of, the massive federal government, and that libraries obviously serve so many purposes and that they are for everyone. And so I think this funding cut is, again, in the government's attempt to, to scale back spending, and that, the government doesn't have to be in the business of funding libraries and museums, because similarly, the National Endowment for the Humanities has also faced approximately a $200 million cut, which the folks over at Illinois Humanities are raising, the flag and sounding all the alarm bells over, because it puts a decent-sized dent in their budget, about $1 million. And, they all say that these are important functions that are being served, that libraries do more than provide free books. They also help to bridge the digital divide. They also provide programming for the elderly and young people.
Absolutely.
The folks at museums are saying, your children go to the museums and they learn at museums as well, not just in schools. And that by cutting this funding this way, that you're really putting a dent in learning and helping people, that and anyone can receive
right.
support from these institutions.
The domino effect continues. Tom, you wrote a story this week. It was about Chicago police being told to report migrant arrests to federal authorities. What are the details there?
Yeah, so this kind of came about. We were interested in how the police department is handling migrants who come into custody and specifically people that they've labeled, you know, as potential associates of this gang, Trende Aragua, that's become kind of, you know, the big boogeyman that Trump and his administration is putting up in terms of their immigration crackdown. So we wound up finding people who the police department had associated with Trende Aragua. And then we looked at the reports, and a lot of them mentioned daily briefings or alerts from different law enforcement agencies. So we said, well, let's look at the briefings and these alerts. And in one of these, the briefing materials for one of these briefings in October of 2023, in the Near West District, the 12th District, there was a directive to officers to tell the Department of Homeland Security, which includes ICE, about any, quote, migrant arrests involving people who had tattoos or clothing associated with this gang, Trende Aragua. Mm-hmm. And obviously that raises a flag because we are a sanctuary city. We have a sanctuary ordinance. We have a sanctuary state law that prohibits Chicago police and you know, from working with federal law or federal immigration enforcement officials and from, you know, inquiring about or investigating about someone's immigration status.
So how did this happen?
You know, they've opened an investigation since we started asking about it. Superintendent Larry Snelling said he believes this might have just been a mistake. He insisted to us that he'd spoken to high-ranking officials in the police department who said that this didn't result in any notifications to the feds about any, quote, migrant arrests. But Mayor Brandon Johnson really distanced himself from this and really disavowed what we saw in these slides from this presentation. He said that doesn't represent, you know, how we're dealing with community safety within our administration.
Right.
And this directive did not come from me, Mayor Brandon Johnson. So, you know, it continues to raise concerns about this really fine line that law enforcement officers in Chicago walk when they, you know, in terms of how they deal with federal officials, right? Because they can work with the FBI or Homeland Security investigations on a criminal investigation, right?
Yeah.
There's just these prohibitions around immigration enforcement and around investigating about someone's immigration status.
Right. Very sticky.
Right. And so what you know, advocates essentially told us was like, well, this appears to us to really violate the spirit of these sanctuary protections, but it also could be just an example of how you can skirt around them. Mm. And so something that we reported about and we're obviously going to continue to look
for. For sure. Turning to something very different, the national measles outbreak, it's getting closer to Chicago. Indiana has announced it has six cases. The Hoosier state joins six other states that all have more than three confirmed cases. So we should note the U.S. already has more than double the number of measles cases it saw all of last year. So we're definitely going to keep an eye on that in the weeks to come. Now I want to switch gears here. Very sad news, Tom. A tragedy. This is out of a Northwest Side Chicago police station. Happened this week. What do we know?
Officer Melissa Torres was off duty when she shot and killed herself in a bathroom at the 18th District Police Station. She was found by her colleagues. One of them described her to me as a very warm and welcoming person. Mm. When you talked with her, you just had that comfortable feeling, like, you know, she actually listened and cared. She was adored. She was relatively new on the force. Her husband is also an officer. Tragedy, just another in a line of suicides that have really rocked the Chicago Police Department. It is an issue that just continues to come up. During the past administration under David Brown, you know, cops were really being stretched thin. There was a rise in homicides. It was the pandemic. We had the looting. Mm-hmm. Days off were canceled. And there was really this mental strain that seemed to be associated with these spates of suicides. But
right.
Since the change in leadership, you know, we've continued to see suicides happen. Yeah.
So sad. Our thoughts are definitely with Officer Melissa Torres' family and colleagues. Cook County Commissioners approved a one-time $1,000 payment for homeowners struggling with big property tax hikes. Now, before anyone gets too excited, some details. Your tax bill must have climbed at least 50% in any year since 2021, and you must be below a certain income. If you want more details on that, just check out our website, wbez.org. And we've got a couple of college football stories. Former Northwestern football players have agreed to a settlement with the university over alleged hazing and abusive behavior. And over on the south side, Chicago State University has named its first football coach, Brandis. Who's Bobby Rome? What should we know?
I should mention that my money was on Deion Sanders before he was named. I was like, it's going to be Deion Sanders, right?
No, no, no.
I learned.
We got Bobby Rome.
We got Bobby Rome, everybody. Bobby Rome II, originally from Norfolk, Virginia, 38 years old. He played for the Tar Heels. He played for UNC. And interestingly, he shared a QB room for a while with a fellow Tar Heels backup. Some of you might know him. His name is Ben Johnson, you know, the Bears coach. Yes.
Yes.
your colleagues at the Sun-Times suggest that maybe he should reach out. but it is his coaching path that is a little strange. Like, I think he played and then later coached in literally the middle of nowhere, Russia. Like the city, the town, it's like 9 hours by flight from Moscow. So that's, and it's like next to China.
Oh, my goodness.
He did that. And then I think he also coached at a couple of the small HBCUs where they did not have the best record for those teams. And, you know, I think it's cool that
But I'm sure he learned a lot.
I'm sure he learned a lot.
And he brings that experience to Chicago State.
And he is ready to bring a winning team to Chicago State. They've got some details to work out. No players, no facility, you know, that kind of stuff. But yeah. I'm sure they'll get there.
Quinn, old school pool halls are making a comeback. What's coming to the Westdown neighborhood?
Well, yes, this is a kind of fancier version of your dad's pool hall. If you're staying in the car while he's going to shoot a couple games. This is going to have a craft cocktail bar. It's called Surge. There's already one in Albany Park. You might have been there. There's one in Logan Square. There's one coming to Westdown on Chicago Avenue. It's going to open later this year. Pool, you know, pool leagues are kind of a booming thing in Chicago.
I like pool.
Yeah, it's super fun.
It's fun.
And, you know, I think the pool hall maybe has somewhat of a negative reputation, but I think, you know, Surge is trying to make it more family friendly and more, you know, millennial hipster vibe.
Interesting. I've got to check it out.
You got to check it out.
Now, it doesn't feel like alfresco weather yet, but it will soon be here. I promise it's coming. Farmers markets, though, they're starting to prepare for that warmer weather. You were looking into that, Quinn.
Well, there, you know, Block Club, we cover all the farmers markets, you know, probably none more so than the Logan Square Farmers Market, which is the city's largest, and it's usually insane. I live in Logan Square and I go, but I would recommend going right when they start at, I think, 9 a.m. on Sundays if you want to get fresh produce. Otherwise, it becomes, you know, kind of a crazy scene. It was, I don't know if I can say this on the radio, it was known as the horny farmers market, where people would go and maybe, maybe look for a date there or meet someone. So, you know, it is, farmers market season is upon us, even though it is like 40 degrees out. Soon enough, you can be drinking your iced coffee and walking down the street and getting some produce.
Do you all have a favorite farmers market that you want to shout out?
Horner Park. That's my...
What I think you were going to say what Quinn just said.
It's not horny. It's mostly people with strollers. But you also have to get, you really have to get there early or else, you know, you have no chance at the Barada or,
you know. Yeah, the good stuff.
That's classic. Yeah, like, you got to get to the farmer's market earlier. You've got no chance at the Barada.
The Wicker Park Farmer's Market I would also recommend. And Wicker Park is a good one as well.
Okay, okay. If you're looking for something new to do tonight, maybe you want to check out Windy City Riot at the Wintrust Arena on the near south side. What is Windy City Riot, you ask? Well, I'll tell you. It's Japanese professional wrestling. And according to a Block Club article, because Block Club covers everything,
as we know,
it's got quite the following in Chicago.
I guess so.
Sources say.
News to us.
This is absolutely news to me. But, you know, Chicago does have a bit of a, you know, indie wrestling scene. I've been to what's called.
How do you know
called,
this?
Well,
because
I
works for Block Club.
I've been to what they're called freelance wrestling. That's one of the promoters in Logan Square. Basically, it's like, not quite, I wouldn't say it's quite minor league wrestling, but it is kind of WWE style wrestling. So this is, you know, not quite the same thing, but you know, there's a huge wrestling fan base here. So this sounds pretty exciting.
Yeah, I think I want to try it out. Oh, and one of our engineers is going to a wrestling thing tonight in Logan, apparently.
There
so there's lots of wrestling.
There's wrestling.
Who knew?
As Quinn
April
just
is,
said.
April that... is wrestling month.
I guess so. All right.
All right. We'll leave it there. That is it for the weekly news recap. My thanks to WTTW's Brandis Friedman, Quinn Myers of Block Club Chicago, and Tom Shuba of the Chicago Sun-Times. I hope you all have a wonderful weekend.
Me too. Thanks for having us.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely.